Hello and welcome to episode one of Rooted, a Science Podcast. Today on the show, we are going to be uncovering the mystery of a banded bald eagle's death, including a viral TikTok video that may or may not have captured her last moments. We are also going to be diving into a topic that has been all over the news lately and that many of us have to thank for rising egg prices, avian influenza. So, stay tuned, and I hope you enjoy the show. The Majestic. Well, mostly, bird that can be seen soaring across the United States and most of Canada. You probably think they sound a lot like this. That was a red-tailed hawk. Now, prepare yourself for the fierce cry of the bald eagle. A little underwhelming, huh? Well, there's at least one thing most people get right about the bald eagle. They're our national bird. Except that wasn't true up until December of last year, when President Biden signed a piece of legislation that designated the national bird as this one, the bald eagle, that has appeared on our Great Seal for over two centuries. Another thing you may or may not know about bald eagles is that they were on the endangered species list up until 2007. This was due to historical practices like trapping and shooting, and most significantly, the use of harmful pesticides like DDT. Fortunately, since the banning of DDT, thanks Rachel Carson, wild bald eagle populations have rebounded, and today, they're doing pretty great. However, the story I'm about to tell you involves a bald eagle that was banded along a beach in Washington State and turned up dead on another about 50 miles away. To trace her final steps, I turn to local raptor expert Dan Varland. Okay, to start off, if we could do a brief introduction, please state your name and position, and then talk a little bit about how you got into the field of raptor research.
Okay, great. Happy to do so, Madeline. So my name is Dan Varland, and I'm the executive director of a small nonprofit on the Washington coast, the name of which is Coastal Raptors. It's a 501c3. And it's been in existence since 2009. And I got into the field of raptor research quite some time ago. I'm 72 years old. And I started out way back in the 60s as a Boy Scout. And I got interested in nature and conservation back then. As a Boy Scout, I reached the rank of Eagle. I went to Eastern Illinois University for my bachelor's degree and actually stayed on for a master's, and both in zoology. As an undergrad, I took ornithology and I just fell in love with birds. But it was after I got done and got started as a community college biology teacher that I got involved in raptor research. And that was through getting involved in raptor banding, first as an apprentice under a permitted master permit holder, and then getting my own master personal permit to band raptors. I decided to, go on for a PhD, which I did at Iowa State University, and I studied the American kestrel for my PhD. They were nesting in nest boxes placed on the backs of interstate highway signs through Interstate 35 in central Iowa. It runs north and south through the whole state. So that's really what got me started. And after I got my PhD, I got a job for a timber company as a wildlife biologist in Western Washington, right in the coastal part of the state along the Pacific. They had spotted owls on the property and they needed a biologist to help them manage their timberlands and manage the regulations. So I did that from 1995 until 2009 when I lost the job with the Great Recession of 2009. And that's when I started the nonprofit Coastal Raptors.
Awesome. Sounds like you have a lot of experience. And so I did want to ask about Coastal Raptors. What's sort of the main focus of Coastal Raptors? Are there any projects that you're working on currently?
Yeah, well, the main focus is, you know, research and education leading to conservation of birds of prey. So we have published five or six papers on the research to date, and I've got one that's coming out this fall. And so we had one on avian scavengers where we were trapping from a fixed position bald eagles, turkey vultures, and common ravens, which a raven's not a raptor, but I call it an honorary raptor because they have a sharp beak, and they're scavengers like raptors are, in addition to being predators. So,
okay, I love this. Welcome to the Raptor Club.
We were trapping those in order to look at contaminants and disease pathogen in the birds. We not only sampled them, but we would mark the birds, and so that we would band the turkey vultures. The bald eagles and the common ravens, and we put wing tags on the turkey vultures. We wouldn't put a band on the leg because turkey vultures poop on their legs as a way to kill bacteria, and it's also believed as a cooling mechanism for them in the warm climates where they live. It would get caught between the band and the leg and cause irritation and problems.
This is called urohydrosis, and it also occurs in long-legged birds like herons and storks.
On top of that, another study that we got involved in was with the Hawk Mountain Sanctuary Association, which is in Pennsylvania, is a satellite tracking of turkey vultures. They've had a long-term study going back to the early 2000s on turkey vultures through satellite telemetry, and we got involved in that with them and put on a total of 8 transmitters starting in 2018. So we have a really nice data set to look at longevity, site fidelity, roost sites, wintering areas, and things like that. So I'm very excited about working on that paper.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see what you guys find out.
Yeah.
So now if we want to turn our focus to a blog post that you did on coastal raptors back in April, March 18th, 2014. A bald eagle is captured and banded with the letters P-O on a beach in Washington State. March 13th, 2025. A couple in South Puget Sound, Washington, notice a bald eagle perched on their deck for over an hour. March 15th, 2025. A bald eagle lands on a deck, stares inside the window, and the occupants take a video, which is later posted to TikTok and Instagram, and goes viral. This bird stays on their porch for 24 hours. March 16th, 2025. A neighbor in the area spots a bald eagle wading through the water to perch on a downed tree. March 22nd, 2025. A bald eagle with the band P-O is found dead on a beach in South Puget Sound, Washington.
A P.O. was caught on the Pacific coast, the outer coast of Washington, on the beach about 2 miles north of the town of Ocean Shores. And it was a terribly rainy day. And I had a number of volunteers that were along just to be part of the process and see how it goes and help out. And so we actually did something that I don't think I've really done with a bird. A couple of people that were along had a house in Ocean Shores. We packed up the bird and went to their garage and processed the bird in their garage because the weather was so rough.
A little bit of context. When Dan said the weather was rough, what he really meant was that they were in a full-on windstorm. So I'll play a clip for you here, courtesy of Coastal Raptors.
Unhooding.
This is PO. Gonna hit the road here. All right.
Some major wind.
And back to the story.
We put a hood on that blocks their vision, and we put booties on their feet so they can't foot us. And then we also, for part of the time, we wrap them in a wrap that's something like a straitjacket. So when we weigh them, we have them completely contained. We put a green band on the left leg, and that one, in this case, had the letters P over O. And so now on the right leg, we put a U.S. Geologic Survey band, a silver band, that has its own unique number. It's like the bird's social security number. And that one you have to recapture the bird to read.
P.O. was later found on a beach in South Puget Sound. How were you informed about that? Did you get a phone call? Do all the reports of your banded birds come directly to you? How does that work?
So what happened was the bird washed ashore, and this was like 54 miles northwest of where we banded the bird and in Puget Sound. And a landowner that goes by JC, she doesn't like to have her last name included, it washed up on her property, and she contacted the Squaxin Island Indian tribe. And a natural resource professional from the tribe came by and picked it up and transferred the carcass to the Billy Frank Jr. National Wildlife Refuge, which used to be called the Nisqually National Wildlife Refuge, south of Tacoma. And a biologist there submitted the data on the bird. That would be the band identification, both the visual identification band and the USGS band, to the Federal Bird Banding Lab, which is in Patuxent, which is in Laurel, Maryland. And they were then notified that I was the bander, and they were provided my contact information. A biologist from the Billy Frank Refuge got in touch with me by email. That's how I found out about it, and it went from there.
So how long do bald eagles typically live, and what was unusual about P.O. washing up on that beach?
I've banded 38 bald eagles over the years from 2008 to 2024, and P.O. was one of the oldest birds in the study. When we banded this bird, first of all, we determined it was a female. The female is in the raptor world are larger than males, and she, through some measurements, we were able to determine she was a female due to her plumage. We determined she was a one-year-old bird at the time. It takes 4 to 5 years, typically, for a bald eagle to reach its white head and tail, and that's when they're sexually mature. And this one was early on in that transition period. And so when I mentioned she's one of the oldest birds in the study, our oldest bird is at least 15 years old. We have one other in addition to a PO that was at least 12 and four others that were at least 11. In answer to your question, how long do they usually live? They, if they survive the first few years, which are, in the bird world, the most difficult, especially the first year as they learn how to hunt, they can easily live for anywhere from 8 to 15 or so years. They don't even breed typically until they're 5, sometimes younger, as I mentioned. So they could be quite long-lived. I expect that some of these birds that we continue to see, in their 11, 12-year-old, that we'll continue to see them through for a number more years.
In your blog, there were a couple of reports from people in the neighborhood around where Pio was found, and they were reporting a bald eagle that was exhibiting unusual behaviors. So what were these unusual behaviors, and what did they lead you to think might be going on?
Okay, so the bird was seen next door to JC, the house next door, literally perched on the railing on their deck, facing the water, and just staring in the window. And it stayed there for an hour and a half before it moved. And when it moved, it flew down to a low point and it landed on in a planter on the ground, at ground level, and stayed there for a while. That's definitely not normal behavior for an eagle. And they had seen it around for about a week. There was another neighbor that also saw it, and at low tide, there was a tree horizontal laying in the water. Eagle walked through the shallow water, hopped up on this tree, and just stayed there for a period of time. And they have sent me a picture of that, as well as a video, by the way, of the other neighbors that had the bird right there on their porch. And in the case of the perching on the tree, that neighbor in the picture that I saw, you cannot see the band at all. With the bird perched on the deck, you can see the band, but it's unreadable, and the neighbor didn't think to look closely and read it. But I'm pretty sure it was my bird. So this bird was, you know, showing some lethargy and irregular behavior for that period of time. And so I concluded at the time that it probably was highly pathogenic avian influenza.
So let's talk a little bit about avian influenza. The World Organization for Animal Health classifies avian influenza based on pathogenicity. In other words, the ability to cause disease. And this is pathogenicity in poultry specifically. So all highly pathogenic avian influenza strains are likely to cause severe disease or death in poultry. Rapid death in poultry, actually. But it's important to note that some low pathogenicity avian influenza strains like H7N9 can cause severe disease and death in humans. So this is a metric in poultry specifically, and does not indicate how the virus is going to act when contracted by humans or other mammals or even other birds. All high pathogenicity strains have been of the H5 and H7 subtypes, where you've all probably heard of H5N1. But what do these H and Ns mean? H stands for hemagglutinin, and N stands for neuraminidase. Both of these are what are known as surface glycoproteins. And so essentially, a glycoprotein is a sugar or carbohydrate chain attached to a protein, and this is something that is on the surface of the virus. And so picture this, a virus, to invade a host, it needs to somehow attach to that host's cells. And to do so, the virus has these surface glycoproteins, and they can bind to the cell surface receptors of the host's organism. And so hemagglutinin is the glycoprotein that initiates that infection. It's what's actually doing the binding to the cell surface receptors. Neuraminidase has sort of an opposite purpose, where it is helping terminate this infectious cycle and allowing the virus to be then released from the cell. And one thing to note is that the viruses need to be able to invade the host organism's cells to replicate. So that's why we see these proteins sort of changing and doing so together. Avian influenza is a type of RNA virus. And what you really need to know is that this has some interesting implications for the way that the virus changes over time. One thing that can occur when two RNA viruses co-infect the same organism, they can do this thing called recombination, where DNA fragments from each of the viruses sort of get mixed. And so this can cause new properties that weren't seen before. And then reassortment is another thing that can occur along with recombination. And reassortment is specifically occurring in viruses with segmented genomes, like avian influenza viruses, where they co-infect the same organism and they can end up switching entire gene segments between these two or more viruses. So those are two things that we need to look out for. But how exactly are these viruses spreading? Aquatic birds like ducks, shorebirds, and gulls are really crucial hosts of low pathogenicity avian influenza strains. This low pathogenicity avian influenza is sort of just passing around populations of aquatic birds, and particularly migratory ones that are moving from place to place. And it causes very few symptoms, sometimes is completely asymptomatic, and these viruses are replicating constantly. So we see highly diverse variants in these populations. In terms of transmission, avian influenza in wild birds is primarily transmitted via the fecal-oral route, and it sticks around in the environment for quite a long time. So a study published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B showed that avian influenza in duck feces can retain the potential for infection for up to 30 days in an environment at the temperature of 4 degrees Celsius. And it can also retain that potential for up to 7 days when the temperature is at 20 degrees Celsius. Another study published in Virology Journal showed that in northern wetlands, like in Alaska and Minnesota, viruses could remain active for over 7 months at the natural temperature. So these avian influenza viruses stick around for quite a long time. And we know that the H5, H7, and H9 subtypes have all crossed the species barrier from birds to mammals. Like cows, for example, we've seen it in seals. And scientists have been particularly worried about if the virus will potentially be able to spread between humans. But something that's interesting to note is that viruses, these avian influenza viruses, prefer neutral to alkaline pH range environments. So their infectivity, their ability to infect organisms, decreases when the pH is lower than 6. When things are more acidic, they really don't like that environment. And something to go along with this is that many waterfowl families have feces with pH in these neutral to alkaline ranges. That is actually a preferred environment for viruses. And so that could suggest a potential reason why we're seeing that these aquatic birds are sort of a natural reservoir for avian influenza. One of the things to look out for is the intermingling of wild birds and domestic poultry. This could potentially cause the spread of avian influenza and eventually the mutation where high pathogenicity avian influenza strains are arising via these mutations in the hemagglutinin cleavage site in the low pathogenicity avian influenza viruses. And so the more often that these viruses are passed amongst the flock of birds, the more likely that there are going to be these mutations. We're particularly worried about H5 or H7 low pathogenicity avian influenza viruses mutating to become highly pathogenic. This has occurred on farms. We see the transmission in poultry to be via the respiratory route, aerosols, respiratory droplets, but we also see it via ingestion of the virus. And so just looking at what sort of the symptoms of highly pathogenic avian influenza is. We see sudden deaths with no accompanying signs or symptoms of illness, but we also see lethargy, a lack of appetite, swelling, discoloration in certain areas. We see respiratory symptoms like difficulty breathing, coughing, sneezing, nasal discharge. And then intestinal symptoms, diarrhea. We see torticollis, which is an interesting condition where birds can get sort of an abnormal head tilt. So their head or neck is twisted in a direction that's not typical for them. And this is also called wry neck or twisted neck. And then we see central nervous system dysfunction, so incoordination, stumbling. And then finally, there can be a drop in egg production. Birds may produce oddly shaped or soft-shelled eggs. Dan had good reason to think that P.O. might have died from avian influenza. One of his most recent papers, which studied the abundance of Peel's peregrine falcons in Washington State, noted a significant drop in the last few sample years. Now, this drop was correlated with an increase in bald eagle sightings. Bald eagles are known as kleptoparasites, which means that they tend to steal food from other birds rather than catching their own prey. So one reason for the correlation between increased bald eagle sightings and decreased peregrine falcon sightings is that bald eagles could be stealing food from the peregrine falcons, which could lead to the peregrine falcons spending less time on the exposed beaches where the surveys were conducted. However, Dan pointed out that there were likely other factors involved.
It was a precipitous drop late in the study, so we think that something else was going on there in addition to bald eagles, and think it very likely could have been highly pathogenic avian influenza. But we don't have any direct evidence. These birds, when they die of bird flu, aren't usually found. We do have one case where one of our birds was found and shipped off to the National Wildlife Health Center in Madison, Wisconsin for necropsy and examination. And it was found that it died of highly pathogenic avian influenza. So it turns out that there have been two strains of this. One that came through in 2014. And another different strain the following year. In following years started, I think I said earlier, in 2022. And that one was much more virulent. And I think it's interesting that in the year of the peak abundance of peregrines on the beach, 2014, 2015, was a year we had a peregrine drop dead of bird flu. So I don't think it's known that it wasn't as pervasive and as virulent as the later strain, which has been a very serious problem for peregrines and other birds as they feed on carcasses of birds that have died from bird flu. Waterfowl are very susceptible. Shorebirds are very susceptible to bird flu and died as a result. And sometimes, of course, they will feed on the lethargic birds. I mentioned that when they get bird flu, they can be sluggish and lethargic, and they look very vulnerable. They're very subject to predation at that point. What I didn't think about, which I should have, was that if a bird gets highly pathogenic avian influenza, it's usually dead within a day or two. And this bird was hanging around for a week. So the bird was tested. It was sent. PO was sent to the School of Veterinary Medicine at Washington State University. They tested the liver and kidney, and they found elevations of lead were in the toxic range. I didn't really think about the possibility it might be lead poisoning, because most raptors are subject to lead poisoning, but most of that occurs in the fall during the hunting season, and it's a result of scavenging on carcasses that have been shot with where the animal has been shot, you know, with a lead bullet, and they feed on the fragments and get lead poisoning from it. And so this PO washed up dead in the spring. And so it didn't occur to me that it might be lead poisoning, which shows many of the same symptoms, lethargy, as well as, sometimes the shakes. They can even go blind as a result of lead poisoning. And so I think what happened to P.O. is that she fed on a varmint that had been shot, like a coyote or something like that. Because as I say, it wasn't the hunting season.
So I did want to briefly touch on, there was a viral TikTok video that was posted in March, and it showcased a supposedly hungry eagle that was perched on a family's porch in the South Puget Sound area and sort of staring into the window at their dog named Noki. And in the video, they're talking about how the bird seems to want to eat Noki or is just staring into the window. That's sort of the same unusual behavior that we were seeing before. So how likely do you think there might be a connection between P.O. and the bird in the video?
Okay, well, so this video looks much the same as the one that the neighbor next to JC had taken. I mean, it's the same background. You can see what looks like Puget Sound water beyond the deck, and the bird looks the same. It does have a green band. In fact, even in the video, it's, you know, they point out, they call it tagged. They said this bird is tagged. And so it's very likely within, a quarter mile, if for likely shorter distance of where JC found the bird dead. Unfortunately, again, the band was not readable from the video. I looked at the video again this morning. I hadn't looked at it since spring, and there have been 3.7 million views of this video with over 3,000 comments. It's on YouTube if listeners want to look at it. The title is "A Hungry Bald Eagle Lands on Our Deck Outside." So a hungry bald eagle lands on our deck outside, and you can see this thing. So this morning I called JC and asked her if she might know these people, because they were identified in the video is Jim and Stacy Goss, G-O-S-S. And I had not done this earlier. I just get busy with other things, but I thought, okay, this is a good time. And she was there, and she said she didn't know the people by that name. But I would say it's the same bird, you know, 99%. I'm 99% sure it's the same bird. And maybe eventually I'll get to the bottom of who those people are. But, you know, it's just, and it never crossed their mind that this could be irregular behavior. They just thought this bird was being friendly.
So I did reach out to Stacy Goss, the original producer of the video, and she was unavailable to meet at the time. But looking back through some of the Instagram posts with photos, in one of the zoomed in shots, there was a barely visible O on the green band of the bird's leg.
I got the same message, which I think is too bad. And I made a brief effort to reach out to the local affiliate in Seattle, but I didn't pursue it very, very hard. But I did check and got a phone number and left a message. Nobody ever called me back from there.
I did think it was mentioned in one of the videos, or maybe an article, that the Department of Fish and Wildlife came out to assess the situation. They concluded that the bald eagle probably ate a large meal, and they stated that bald eagles, after eating large amounts of food, sometimes can't fly, and so they'll end up just kind of having to perch somewhere for a period of time. Does that happen very often?
It's extremely rare. I've heard of it one time, but that's extremely rare. First of all, if he was so fattened, how did he get up on the deck? You know, how did he even fly? I think that's very, very unlikely, especially combined with the fact that it had a green band on and a green banded bird washed up dead from lead poisoning. I mean, I don't accept that. I listened to the video again this morning and was reminded of that. I appreciate bringing that up. I think it's very, very unlikely that that's the source of what happened, but it was found on more than one porch, you know? So how can you be too fat to fly, but you're on two different porches, some, you know, hundreds of yards apart?
So I just wanted to ask really quick, how can the general public report a banded bird if we see one?
Well, you can go online and type into your search bar there, type in bird banding lab, and what will come up is the USGS bird banding lab, and then there'll be options under that, and one of those is report a band. So I just did it knowing that you were going to ask me that question. I just did that this morning just to verify that, and there, you could step through the procedure there. And I would say that most of the reports that I get from birds that have seen the birds that I've marked, whether they're turkey vultures, eagles, peregrine falcons, or a few other species, I get, you know, directly from people that know me. And that's really true, especially true for the peregrine falcons. Not so much so for the turkey vultures, because they spread pretty widely down to Oregon and up to Canada and things. But usually there, the first report comes from the bird banding lab. And then once those people know me, sometimes they see these birds again, they just report directly to me. So the bird banding lab likes to get all of these sightings. So that would be the way to do it.
Dan, along with musician/producer Tony Starlight, composed a cover of the song Band on the Run by Paul McCartney and Wings, which they entitled Band on the Bird. I'll play a little bit for you now to end the episode.
Where the birds exploded with a mighty flash as they flew up from the sand. And the first one said to the second one there, did you see that band? Band on the bird. Band on the bird. Wrapped a Dan and the singing man, a teaching everyone. See the band, band on the bird.
A big thanks to Dan Varland for his fascinating insights into the lives of the raptors soaring above us. If you'd like to check out his blog and more on the story of P.O., please head to www.coastalraptors.com/blog. For this episode, sources on avian influenza, as well as the bald eagle stares in window video, please check out the show notes. Thank you all for listening. And I hope to catch you next time on Rooted.